offering a loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, welcoming you to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam is Prem, and with me is Hari. Those of you who regularly join us in this program every week at this time, you'll know that we study Swami's discourses as part of this program, and the series we are going through now is the 1991 Summer Course series. We are in the 9th discourse in that series. And this series, 91 series, is about the Upanishads. Swami speaks about the various Upanishads, and the one which we are right now going through is the Mundaka Upanishad. Before we summarize what Swami has said so far, because this week we'll conclude that discourse, the last clip which is remaining in that discourse, we'll complete with that. So before we summarize what is there to be said, what Swami has told so far, I invite Hari to join all of us. Sairam Hari.
Sairam Prem.
So as Swami has been telling, this entire Upanishad is based on, again, a conversation between disciple and the Guru.
Hmm.
Disciple more in the sense of a person who is asking the question, not necessarily a disciple-guru relationship like in the case of the Prashna Upanishad,
right,
where they had six disciples asking sage Pipilata the questions. Here, as you've mentioned earlier, there is this householder with a spiritual bent of mind. Sorry, my name is Shaunaka. He comes and asks the question to sage Angirasa. That's how the Upanishad starts. Right.
And what we covered in the last segment, primarily Swami explained this incident that happened between Lord Krishna and Queen Gandhari. This is from the Mahabharata.
Right.
And just to recreate what had happened, essentially it is like after the Mahabharata war, where Queen Gandhari, that is the mother of the Kauravas, she loses all her 100 sons.
Mm.
And she comes with that grief to Lord Krishna, and while she wanted to vent out her grief, it turns to anger, and in that anger, that pent up anger, she says to the Lord that, you know, you have all this time, you have favored the Pandavas, you know, so, and how is this fair that while they are all alive, not even one son of mine is alive today. And with that, Krishna takes this opportunity that even at this time of grief to, and as far as the Lord is concerned, like everyone is his child.
Right.
And they, no matter what, you know, what they have done, what sin they have committed, his love is so bountiful that when they come to him in grief, he will, you know, find a way to take them forward, whatever it is. Like most of us would have assuaged their grief or said something very sympathetic, you know, plucked in sympathy at the very least. But the Lord takes this opportunity to take them forward now. You know, it's a good time. And the Lord alone is the best judge of that.
Mm.
And he says that even though you had all these 100 children, did you ever take the time to sit with them, find out, you know, raise them, rear them, you know, teach them what the right values are? You always, in one sense, like you were blinded, you know, you could never perceive like what was going on, etc. So perhaps all her attention was on her eldest son, Duryodhana, right? So the whole time, so Lord Krishna says that when these are children who were distanced from their mother's grace, how do you imagine that they would have got the grace of the Lord?
Mm.
And this Swami has said in so many discourses, that Swami puts it this way. He says that if you cannot understand the love of your mother, how can you understand the Lord, the love that the Lord confers? Because the Lord's love is like the love of 1,000 mothers.
Right.
And so you got to first learn to appreciate your mother's love. And in this case, of course, he's turning the tables on the mother and saying that when your children do not experience that, they will never know. Yeah, they can never recognize God's love.
So
first and foremost, you got to learn to recognize love in what your mother does.
Mm.
So that is one, you know, both, we can take it both ways. It's a lesson for the children on how to look at their parents, and also a lesson in parenting itself.
Right. That, and I think how Swami comes to this particular conversation between Krishna and Gandhari is,
yes,
sorry, when Swami is talking about the difference between jnana, subjnana and vijnana.
Hmm.
And that's how Swami comes there.
Yeah.
Where he's saying jnana is just knowledge pertaining to the body.
Right.
And that's what Swami says. It's basic knowledge of, of worldly sense. And then Swami says subjnana is that of the mind, where you talk of discrimination, the ability to use your mind to understand some things probably you don't see, probably
correct.
It is not black and white in front of you.
Hmm.
But vijnana, Swami says, is the knowledge of the heart.
Hmm.
And I think in that context, Swami brings this concept.
Hmm.
Because I think there is another conversation which Swami would allude to, where Dhritarashtra has the same question.
Hmm.
He says, in what way are the children of Pandu dearer to you than my children? And that's when Krishna would say that, you can't separate Krishna from the Pandavas.
Hmm.
And Swami would say that, Bhima is my... Nakula, Sahadeva are like my legs.
Hmm.
Bhima is like my stomach. And Arjuna is like my arms.
Hmm.
And Yudhishthira is like my head. And in that thing, Swami would say that it's because of their attachment to goodness, not because of anything else.
Right.
It's not because, I'm favoring them because they are the children of my favorite aunt or there is anything else. The only thing is they stick by goodness, and whoever is upholding dharma, whether or not they willfully do it, they draw me to them. And Krishna says that that's the only difference.
Mm.
That this side people are righteous and your side people are not righteous. And that's all that matters. And that Swami comes to by saying that that righteousness comes by sticking to the subjnana.
Mm.
Constantly thinking that what is that conscience, and aligning yourself, your thoughts and words and actions to that conscience.
Yes, because on discrimination, which you were saying, even at the mental level, discriminating. So I could read a lot of books on philosophy and Western, Eastern, whatever it is, and I might very well be able to distinguish between what is good and what is bad.
Right.
And in fact, in the Mahabharata, it's very often stated that Duryodhana actually, in despair, he goes to Lord Krishna and says, that I know what is good and I know what is bad, but I cannot keep myself, from doing the wrong actions, or I'm unable to choose the right actions. And that is, so that Swami distinguishes that from vijnana. Vijnana is like the actions or the thoughts that emanate, as Swami says, from the heart. And of course, we are speaking about the conscience or the spiritual center of, every human being. So that, as you rightly said, that is the whole context in which this conversation happens.
And of course, before that, Swami speaks about Swami was speaking about the terms akshara, where he says that it is not just the transcendental, but it's a combination of the transcendental and the physical.
That's
where
right.
He says a and kshara, both together.
Right.
And this is, I think, something which I've repeated so many times, when Swami redefined the concept of neti neti. It's not not this.
Right.
It's not only this.
Right.
That, when you say you are not the body, it's not necessarily that the body is not you. In fact, there's a beautiful conversation in which Swami writes, I think in Sandeha Nivarani or Prashnotravahini, where the disciple asks Swami that, is there God in a dead body? And Swami immediately says, yes, of course there is. When a person dies, the God in the body does not leave.
Right.
It's the jivatma which leaves. But God is everywhere, so He is even there in a dead body. So in that sense, it's not that you are the body is not you. It's that the body is not only you, and when you say you are the divine which is complete, body becomes a part of you. It's just that you're not only this body, probably all the bodies are contained in you.
Yes. Because even now it's a very difficult matter to distinguish who we are as consciousness. You could pick up the thread of thoughts, the only thing you got, there's a thread of thoughts that happens, and with each one of thoughts is identified a person called you. And that is what you call as you.
Right.
I like that, the way the philosopher, I can call him, or the intellectual Sam Harris, who says that we are under that illusion that there is a person behind our eyes. But that is an illusion of the continuity of the thoughts that happen, where you are contained. So, in that sense, you can always question. Also, there are very, when you are speaking about the human body, I was just wondering, like, we are not aware that we are not the only organism that is living inside this body. Like, when you actually, I'm not talking about even at the level of the skin, where we can, of course, pick up like millions and millions of germs, bacteria, but verily inside our body, there are so many organisms that exist.
There is that statistic which says there are 90 trillion cells which make up the human body.
Exactly.
Of which only 10 trillion are human cells.
Human cells, exactly.
I mean, which means you're more of something else than human in that sense.
Practically, you are one of the people coexisting in this body.
Exactly. So, in fact, nobody takes more help than, us.
Yeah. Exactly. So, in that sense, it's difficult to even claim this body as ours. So, it's a very nascent idea that we have of who we are.
In fact, the other thing which scientists generally say is, when you sweep your house and sweep your home, most of the dust which comes actually are dead human cells.
Exactly.
So, when you're talking about living for 60 years, 70 years, you've actually, rebuilt this body which you call yourself so many times over.
Correct.
And it's far from what it was when it was born.
Exactly.
It's not just that the body is grown, but its body is literally, revamped so many times.
Yeah, there are a number of such thought experiments, Prem. Like, as you read them one by one, your intuition of who you are, even at a very basic level, gets shaken.
Right.
What constitutes you as a person? Like, there are several thought experiments which can be conducted. Like, one, and there's a very, in Greek philosophy itself, there's a very ancient question which comes from, it's given this very nice name of the Ship of Theseus.
Right.
Which I think we had spoken about earlier. The very simple question is this, like, so imagine that there is this wooden ship, it's called the Ship of Theseus, and it is made of several wooden planks. So over time, the planks get replaced one by one, till at one point of time, you got like a brand new ship, like all the parts have been completely changed.
But over a long period of time.
Over a very long period of time. So what constitutes, why do we still call it the Ship of Theseus? Is it still the same ship as before? And I think, as you mentioned, even at that time, the reason it is called the Ship of Theseus is there is the aspect of continuity from, it has been continuously, it's not that it is completely dismantled and, So in very small increments it has changed. Just as we, from childhood to adults, the changes are so very incremental. So people who view us, or even we who view ourselves, we can see that continuity, and hence we can comfortably call ourselves the same person as that which existed, say, 30, 40 years back.
I think, in many ways, that's what knowledge is meant to do. Like, for instance, if you talk about our political leanings, I think nowadays it's very clear that you're a leftist, you're a rightist,
polarized,
far right.
Polarized,
But what happens when you very open-mindedly read history?
Correct.
If you read what the countries which claim to be left have done, what countries which claim to be capitalist have done, what countries which claim to be right, like the Allied forces have done, you will realize that no one is clean as white.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. And it only gives you that idea that you cannot hold up any ideology as being supreme or anything like that.
Perfect.
And that wisdom comes when you actually gain more knowledge, when you are exposed to knowledge which is not polarized by any other idea. And the same thing is what is happening in the concept of Vedanta. We might not reach that state already, but that information is constantly, it's being given to you.
Right.
This is what it is. You're not the body.
Yeah.
Because these are the various factors. Are you the eye that sees? Are you the ear that hears? And are you the thoughts which arise in your mind? Constantly, when logically all this knowledge is placed in front of you, it starts breaking down all your ideas of, world and happiness and success and everything. I think that's what it happens. Because otherwise, you tend to think that, hey, what is the point of saying I am God when I don't have that experience?
Exactly. So this knowledge is essentially unlearning, more than learning.
Exactly.
It
breaks you down completely.
The whole process of unlearning. Because a lot of things, I think we spoke about this again a few segments before, that a lot of thoughts that we have, even right now, are inherited thoughts. I think within a certain framework. As an Indian and as a Hindu, I speak within a certain framework.
Right.
And I have certain options. I may feel that I'm a free thinker. and yet I may be thinking only within a box.
Absolutely.
And that box is something I've inherited.
Mm.
And it takes a lot of, you know, they say like the lot of traveling is only education. So
true.
You get exposed to different kinds of people, mm. you know. Say, I speak to a Muslim, I speak to a Christian, I speak to a Westerner, I speak to a person from the Far East.
Mm.
And then I begin to look at, okay, there are, you know, different standpoints that exist.
Mm.
You know, like, for example, a few days back, I was speaking to a Muslim student from Australia.
Right? Okay.
And while speaking, this was a lady, and while speaking to her, you know, all of a sudden, the perspective, I could see things from her point of view. You know, the kind of humiliation how she feels.
Mm.
As a youngster, she's very young and she's not able to comprehend, you know, how in Australia, she still feels, you know, she's free to practice her religion, but the way the rest of the world, you know, views. So standing in her point of view, how the world appears.
Mm.
And that completely alters, you know, that moment, it was an immediate broadening I experienced. And even to think that after a lot of reading, after a lot of speaking, that shift can still happen.
Mm.
Right?
I think that's probably one of the meanings. There are many meanings to the statement which Swami makes.
Mm.
Swami says the proper study of mankind is man.
Yeah.
No, unless you really study a variety, you know, you go out of your community, you go out of your country, or I mean, not necessarily physically, intellectually,
right. Yes.
And in the sense of gaining knowledge.
Right.
That's when you actually get an idea of man. I mean, forget about history, forget about countries or religions. Because when you read, for instance, when you read about the wars, when you read about
history.
Conquests over many centuries, you realize that, you know, whoever man is, whichever part of the world he is born in, power spoils you. Right? You know, you could be raised a Hindu, you could be raised a Christian, you could be raised anything
Correct.
Else.
Yes.
But if power is given and, you know, it is not given with conditions, it tends to consume you and tends to spoil you.
Yeah.
And
power,
this, right?
Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts
absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And unless you see this phenomenon happening with a variety of people and variety of civilizations,
right.
You will not understand that this is the frailty of human nature.
There is.
Right?
And the biggest, I wouldn't say mistake, but one of the biggest obstacles we'll face is definitely hanging on to our opinions as being right. So they say, you know, one of the, like somebody I know, he was saying, if only I could invent a machine that everybody could carry with them and that machine kept telling them, yes, you're right, yes, you're right, yes, you're right, over, you know, 100 times a day.
Mm.
So that at some point of time, they would be ready to drop their, you know, whatever they're holding on to as being right and listen to the opposite person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is said that, you know, Bertrand Russell, very famous philosopher, and he held very revolutionary beliefs. I mean, they actually influenced a lot of philosophers. And once he was asked, like, you know, about your convictions, he said, like, would you be ready to die for your beliefs? And he said, no, I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And the questioner was very taken aback and asked, how come? Like, you're so strongly you present your convictions. And he says, but they could be wrong. It's as simple as that. He said, they could be wrong. It is said about, you know, another philosopher, I forget his name right now, Wittgenstein. Yes, he was and as a very young philosopher, again, he was a protege, a student of Bertrand Russell.
Mm-hmm.
So when he first came over from Germany to London to meet Bertrand Russell, and he was asked to make a presentation about his ideas in a very small, motley group of, elite group of, in fact, philosophers. And one of the philosophers, he says, I instantly recognized Wittgenstein's genius.
Mm.
And he was asked how, because the others were perplexed.
Mm.
Because the whole time Wittgenstein, it was like as he was speaking, he was doubting what he was saying.
Contradicting himself.
Yeah, and contradicting himself at times. Mm. And he said, that is how I know that he's a true philosopher.
Mm.
That, you know, he's never convinced of what he's saying. He's still doubting, he's still exploring, even as he's presenting what he thinks is right.
I think you also mentioned about the Nasadiya Suktam, right?
Yeah. The Nasadiya Suktam, it has a very interesting twist at the end, you know.
Mm.
Like, so it speaks about, like how the creation happens and, you know, how ultimately it speaks of a Lord, right? We conceive, at least the mantras lead you to believe that we're speaking about a Lord who is looking at all of this from above, the entire creation, and knows every, you know, thing that is happening, knows all about the secret of creation.
Mm.
But the final question is, does he even know? You know?
Mm.
It's like
how do you know he knows?
Yeah. Pardon me?
How do you know he knows?
Not even how do you know. Like the question is, does he know?
Does he even know?
You know, that's it. So the question stops right then and there, and like, it's a mystery for the rest of mankind to ponder over.
Like, you know, talking about expanding our ideas and that leading to true understanding many a times. There's this quote which I read long back, I don't know whose it is. It says, problems are never solved by putting people in their places, but putting yourself in their places.
Oh, fantastic, yes.
Right, you know. Yeah. That's really, I mean, in the present scenario, that's something which we really need to understand, you know. There is no black and white. And only when you know there is no black and white, you will be critical of your own actions also.
Right.
You know, of your own likes and dislikes. That is what Sujnana is all about. There is nothing like anybody is infallible. No leader can be perfect all the time.
Correct.
In all their decisions.
Correct.
The ability to look at everything case by case and say that this is right, this is wrong.
Correct.
You know, that is what dharma is all about. In fact, this morning in the satsang we were talking about Vidura.
Mm.
Right? Vidura was one person who stood for that.
Mm.
He said at any time fearlessly he could get up and tell the king this is right,
this is
wrong.
Yeah.
And he was literally a thorn in the flesh for Dhritarashtra, because every time Dhritarashtra was habituated to do the wrong thing all the time, and Vidura would never fail to tell him that what he was doing is wrong.
And how many of us are so fortunate to have such wise counsel beside us? No, I wish, like, you know, so many times CEOs ask for coaches, you know, mentors to have them take the right decisions, like day after day after day, which affect millions of people, right, or thousands of people who are holding jobs under them.
Mm.
And there is Dhritarashtra having the best of the best.
Yeah. Right. So I think we'll go to the last clip in that discourse.
Yes.
We'll see how Swami concludes this discourse.
Therefore, the one who enjoys the God's sight, the great
will
enjoy. If he is away, far away from the sight of God, he doesn't deserve the grace of anyone.
ఒక సమీపంలో ఉండినటువంటి వ్యక్తిని, నాయన నీవు చాలా మంచివాడని సమీపం చేస్తే అందరూ అతన్ని ప్రేమిస్తారు.
If anyone says towards a fellow who is quite close by, if you say, you're a good man, everybody will come to him. If he keeps him at distance, the world also will start hating him.
కనుకని ఏదానిని మనం గుర్తించుకుంటే, సర్వమును గుర్తించుకున్న వారం అవుతామంటే, ఒక దైవత్వాన్ని గుర్తించుకుంటే, ఈ యొక్క విశ్వమంతా కూడాను దైవం యొక్క సృష్టిలోని భాగమే.
When once we recognize the divinity, the whole universe can be understood, because the universe is a part of divinity. The world is not understanding this principle of equality. There is a coin. People started looking it on one side. If they see the second side also, they can have the complete vision. We are not taking care of the second side. One is the world, prakriti, the other one is paratattva, divinity. One is the kshara, the other one is akshara. One is the
moolamu, the other one is daniki adharam.
One is the base, the other is base.
Stoolam.
One is the gross, other is
the gross.
But we look at stoola gross.
కేవలం ప్రకృతిని చూస్తున్నారు.
వి లుక్ ఎట్ ద వరల్డ్.
కేవలం భౌతికాన్ని చూస్తున్నారు.
వి లుక్ ఎట్ ది ఫిజికల్
వరల్డ్. కేవలం లౌకికని అనుభవిస్తున్నారు.
వి ఎక్స్పీరియన్స్ వరల్డ్లీ థింగ్స్.
కనుకని ఈ నిత్య సత్యమైనటువంటి యొక్క మూలమును ఎవరు కూడాను చూడటం లేదు.
దేర్ఫోర్ నో వన్ ట్రైస్ టు అండర్స్టాండ్
ద రూట్ కాజ్. మూలాన్ని చూచినప్పుడే,
when once you understand the root cause,
సర్వము మన చరిత్ర ఏమంటై కూడాను అర్థమవుతుంది.
ఎవ్రీథింగ్ ఇన్ హిస్టరీ కుడ్ బి అండర్స్టూడ్.
కనుకని భగవంతుని యొక్క చరిత్ర అనేటువంటిది ఇట్టిది అట్టిది అని ఎవరు చెప్పలేరు.
సో హిస్టరీ ఆఫ్ ది డివైన్ నో వన్ కెన్ డిస్క్రైబ్.
రాసినటువంటి వ్రాతలను పట్టి,
బేస్డ్ ఆన్ రైటింగ్స్,
చెప్పినటువంటి బోధనలు పట్టి,
బేస్డ్ ఆన్ టీచింగ్స్,
మనము అర్థం చేసుకుని విరోధము ఇష్టము రెండింటినీ మనం పెంచుకుంటున్నాం.
వీ డెవలప్ ది ఫీలింగ్స్ ఆఫ్ హేట్రిడ్ అండ్ డిజైర్, లైకింగ్, బేస్డ్ ఆన్ దీస్ థింగ్స్.
ఈ రెండింటి యొక్క పూర్ణత్వాన్ని మనం గుర్తించుకోవడానికి ప్రయత్నించాలి.
వీ షుడ్ అండర్స్టాండ్ ది యాక్చువాలిటీ బిహైండ్ దీస్.
కృష్ణుడు ఇలాంటి వాడు అని గ్రంథంలో రాయటం వల్ల, పెద్దలు చెప్పటం వల్ల అతను చాలా అసహ్యంగా భావిస్తాం కొత్త.
బికాస్ టెక్స్ట్ డిస్క్రైబ్ దట్ వే, ది ఎల్డర్స్ స్టార్టెడ్ ప్రాపగేట్.
రాముడు ఇలాంటి వాడు అని చెప్పడం చేత దానిని మనం విశ్వసిస్తుంటాం.
వెన్ పీపుల్ సే రామా ఇస్ దట్ షార్ట్, వీ డెవలప్ ఫెయిత్ టువర్డ్స్.
రెండింటినీ కాదు, మనము అందులో ఉన్నటువంటి నిజమైనటువంటి యొక్క సత్యాన్ని మనం గుర్తించాలి.
నాట్ దిస్ టూ, వీ షుడ్ అండర్స్టాండ్ ది ట్రూత్ బిహైండ్ దీస్ టూ.
ఈ రెండింటికి ఆధారం ఒక సత్యం ఉంటుండాలి.
దేర్ ఇస్ వన్ బేసిస్ ద ట్రూత్ బిహైండ్ దీస్ టూ.
కనుకనే గోపికలు కూడాను ఒకనాడు చెప్పారు.
సో గోపికాస్ ఆల్సో సెడ్ ఆన్ వన్ డే,
కృష్ణ,
దే సెడ్ కృష్ణ,
కేవలము మా కన్నులు కనిపిస్తున్నాయి.
వీ సీ విత్ అవర్ ఐస్,
మా కన్నులతో మిమ్మల్ని చూస్తున్నాము.
వీ సీ యూ విత్ అవర్ ఐస్,
ఈ కన్నులతో చూచినటువంటిది ఎంతకాలం సత్యము?
దాట్ విచ్ యూ సీ విత్ ఐస్,
ఎంతకాలం సత్యం అవుతాయి.
దే ఆర్ ట్రూ సో లాంగ్ ది ఐస్ ఆర్ దేర్.
కనుక ఈ సత్యం మాకు సత్యం కాదు.
ద ట్రూత్ ఈజ్ నాట్ ట్రూత్ టు అస్.
మేము హృదయంతో చూస్తున్నాము.
వీ షుడ్ సీ విత్ ది హార్ట్.
హృదయం అంతా మాలిన్యమైనటువంటి ఒక కోనేరుగా ఉంటుండాలి.
ది హార్ట్ ఈజ్ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్ డర్ట్, ద డర్ట్ ఆఫ్ లేక్.
కనుక అందులో నీ యొక్క దీనిని కూడా మేము సరిగా చూడలేకుండా పోతున్నాం.
దేర్ ఆల్సో వీ కెనాట్ సీ యూ క్లియర్లీ.
మా కన్నులలో ఉన్నటువంటి సెంటర్ మధ్యలో ఉండేటువంటి భాగము నలుపు.
ద సెంటర్ ఆఫ్ ది ఐ ఈజ్ డార్క్.
నీ స్వరూపం కూడాను నలుపే.
యువర్ ఫామ్ ఈజ్ ఆల్సో బ్లాక్.
మా హృదయంలో చూస్తామంటే ఈ మానస్ సరోవరం అంతా కూడా మాలిన్యంతో చేరి నలుపుగా ఉంటుండాలి.
వెన్ వీ థింక్ అవ్ అవర్ హార్ట్ ద లేక్ ఈజ్ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్ డర్ట్.
ఇందులో కనిపించేటువంటి యొక్క రిఫ్లెక్షన్ ఆకాశం కూడాను నల్లగానే ఉంటుండాలి.
ద రిఫ్లెక్షన్ ది ఆకాశ రిఫ్లెక్షన్ ది ఆకాశ ఈజ్ ఆల్సో డార్క్.
కనుక మా హృదయంలో నిన్ను చూడవని అనుకుంటే,
ఇఫ్ యూ వాంట్ టు సీ యూ ఇన్ అవర్ హార్ట్,
మా కన్నులు నీవు మార్చనక్కర్లేదు.
యూ నీడ్ నాట్ చేంజ్ అవర్ హార్ట్.
నీ రూపాన్ని అంతకంటే నువ్వు మార్చుకోనక్కర్లేదు.
యూ నీడ్ నాట్ చేంజ్ యువర్ ఫామ్ ఐదర్.
మా ఈ యొక్క డర్టీ మనసును దీన్ని కూడా నీవు ఈ క్లీన్ చేయమని మేము కోరం.
వీ డోంట్ రిక్వెస్ట్ యూ టు క్లీన్ అవర్ డర్టీ హార్ట్ ఐదర్.
కానీ దీనికి బ్యాక్గ్రౌండ్ నల్లగుండేటువంటి యొక్క స్కైని దాన్ని కొంచెం మార్చు, తెల్లదిగా మార్చు.
But the background, the dark sky, you make it bright.
అదే మా హృదయము.
That is our heart.
మా హృదయాన్ని బ్యాక్గ్రౌండ్ గా ఉండేటువంటి హృదయాన్ని తెల్లగా మారిస్తే నీ నల్లని స్వరూపము ఆ తెల్లని బ్యాక్గ్రౌండ్ లో చక్కగా కనిపిస్తుంది అన్నారు.
If you make our hearts bright, then we can see your reflection which is dark very clearly.
కనుక మా హృదయాన్ని మార్చమన్నారు.
Therefore, change your hearts, they pray.
దీని యొక్క అంతరార్థం ఏమిటి?
వాట్ ఇస్ ది ఇన్నర్ సిగ్నిఫికెన్స్ ఆఫ్ దిస్?
ప్రపంచంలో మనం మారనక్కర్లేదు.
వీ డోంట్ నీడ్ టు చేంజ్ ఇన్ ది వరల్డ్.
మన యొక్క మనసును మార్చుకోనక్కర్లేదు.
వీ డోంట్ నీడ్ టు చేంజ్ అవర్ మైండ్.
మన ప్రజ్ఞాన సంబంధమైనటువంటి హృదయాన్ని మనం మార్చుకుంటే,
వెన్ వన్స్ వీ చేంజ్ అవర్ మైండ్ విచ్ ఇస్ ప్రజ్ఞాన,
మనసు కేవలం మాలిన్యమైనటువంటిది.
ద మైండ్ ఇస్ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్
ఎంత కడిగినా కూడా దీని మాలిన్యం పోదు.
అవర్ వెల్ యూ మే వాష్ యూ కెనాట్ మేక్ ఇట్ క్లీన్.
బొగ్గు పాలగడగా పోవునా మలినంబు. బొగ్గు పాలగడగా పోవునా మలినంబు.
కెన్ యూ క్లీన్ ద కోల్ వెన్ ఇట్ ఈవెన్ ఇఫ్ యూ కీప్ ఇట్ ఇన్ మిల్క్?
బొగ్గు నల్లగా ఉందని పాలం తెచ్చి బాగా కడితే బొగ్గు తెల్లగవుతుందా? పాలు కూడా నల్లగా అయిపోతాయి.
ది కోల్ ఇస్ బ్లాక్ యూ కెనాట్ క్లీన్ ఇట్, క్లెన్స్ ఇట్ విత్.
బొగ్గును సోప్తో తిక్కుదామంటే సోపు కూడా నల్లగా అయిపోతుంది.
వెన్ యూ వాంట్ టు వాష్ ఇట్ విత్ సోప్ ఇట్ ఆల్సో బికమ్స్ బ్లాక్.
చక్కగా థింక్ చేయాలి విద్యార్థులు.
స్టూడెంట్స్ షుడ్ థింక్ క్లియర్లీ.
ఈనాడు ఈ బొగ్గు కావడానికి పూర్వం దీని రూపం ఏమిటి?
Today we find the coal. What is its earlier form?
దీనికి పూర్వము కర్ర.
Earlier it is wood.
ఈ కర్ర కాలకం చేతనే బొగ్గుగా అయిపోయింది.
Because the wood which is burnt turns into wood at this coal.
కానీ ఈ బొగ్గుగా కావడానికి ఏమిటి కారణము? ఈ అగ్ని పరిపూర్ణంగా దీన్ని కాల్చలేదు.
How has it come to structure coal? Because the fire has not burnt it in full.
కనుక ఈ యొక్క బొగ్గును తిరిగి అగ్నిలోనే వేచి పరిపూర్ణంగా కాల్చినప్పుడు అదే వైట్ అండ్ లైట్ గా తయారైపోతుంది.
సో వెన్ వన్స్ యూ బ్రింగ్ బ్యాక్ ద కోల్ ఇన్ ద ఫైర్, ఇట్ కంప్లీట్లీ బర్న్ట్, ఇట్ ట్రాన్స్ఫార్మ్స్ ఇన్ టు.
బొగ్గును తెల్లగి చేయాలంటే పాలతో కలిగితే తెల్లగి కాదు, తిరిగి అగ్నిలోనే వెయ్యాలి.
వెన్ యూ వాంట్ టు మేక్ ఇట్ బ్రైట్ యూ షుడ్ నాట్ వాష్ ఇట్ మిల్క్.
ఈ బొగ్గును అగ్నిలో వేసి కాల్చి 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 వేస్తే తెల్లని ఒక ధూళిగా తయారైపోతుంది.
వెన్ వన్స్ యూ కీప్ ఇట్ ఇన్ ఫైర్ అగైన్ బికాస్ ఆఫ్ కంటిన్యూస్ బర్నింగ్ ఇట్ బికమ్స్ బ్రైట్.
అనుగ్రహం అనేటువంటి అగ్నిలోనే దీన్ని వేసి, నేనిప్పుడు బొగ్గుగా ఉంటున్నాను, అక్కడ కర్రగానూ లేదు, ఇక్కడ ఒక విధమైన ధూళిగానూ లేదు, బొగ్గుగా తయారైపోయాను.
ఐఎమ్ నాట్ ఇన్ ద ఫార్మ్ ఆఫ్ వుడ్, ఐఎమ్ నాట్ ఇన్ ద ఫార్మ్ ఆఫ్ యాష్, ఐఎమ్ ఇన్ ద ఫార్మ్ ఆఫ్ కోల్ ప్రెసెంట్లీ.
కనుక నా యొక్క ఆది అంత్యమును రెండు మర్చి మధ్యలో ఉండటం చేతనే ఇది బొగ్గుగా రూపొందాను.
ఐ హావ్ ఫర్గాటన్ ద బిగినింగ్ అండ్ ది ఎండ్, దేర్ఫోర్ ఐ స్టాండ్ ఇన్ బిట్వీన్ ఇన్ ద ఫార్మ్ ఆఫ్ ఎ కోల్.
కనుక బిగినింగ్ నేను ఆది వదిలిపెట్టాను.
ఐ లెఫ్ట్ ద బిగినింగ్.
కర్ర మారిపోయింది,
ఇట్స్ గాన్.
కానీ నేను అంత్యానికి పోయి చేరాలి.
బట్ ఐ షుడ్ రీచ్ ద ఎండ్.
అంత్యానికి చేయాలంటే నీ అగ్ని సంస్కారం మరింత అధికంగా కావాలి.
టు రీచ్ ద ఎండ్ దిస్ బర్నింగ్ ప్రాసెస్ ఇస్ నెసెసరీ.
కనుక మన మనస్సు అనేటువంటిది ఒక బొగ్గుగా మారిపోయింది.
ద మైండ్ హ్యాస్ బికమ్ ఎ కోల్.
ఆదిని మర్చిపోయినాము.
That is forgotten.
అంత్యం చేరుకోవడానికి ప్రయత్నించడం లేదు.
Not making effort to reach.
మధ్యలో ఉంటుంది మనం ఈ కష్టములకు దుఃఖములకు గురి అయిపోతున్నాము.
We pass through the difficulties and sorrows while staying in
between. జగత్ యొక్క శాంతిని మనం పొందాలి.
We should have the peace.
మానసిక శాంతిని పొందాలి.
We should have mental peace.
ఆత్మ శాంతిని పొందాలి.
We should have ఆత్మిక peace.
అందుకోసమనే శాంతి 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 అని మూడు శాంతిని మనం నిత్యము ఉచ్చరిస్తున్నాము.
It is for that reason the word శాంతి is repeated thrice.
కనుక మొట్టమొదట దేహ శాంతిని చేరాలి.
The first peace.
దేహ శాంతి కావాలనుకుంటే నామస్మరణ చాలా అవసరం.
If you want to have peace of the body,
మానసిక శాంతి కావాలంటే బ్రహ్మ భావం అత్యవసరం.
If you want to have the mental peace, the
హృదయ శాంతి కావాలంటే సాధన మనకు అత్యవసరం.
That sadhana is necessary.
కనుక దేహం నుండి మనస్సు మనసు నుంచి ఆత్మకు మనం ప్రయాణం చేయాలి.
Therefore, from body we should travel to the mind and then to the atma finally.
Swami ends that discourse with that, and when you just listen to that clip, you know, if you listen to an entire discourse, it's a different thing. But if you listen to just that one clip, you wouldn't realize that Swami is now actually explaining about the Upanishads. Because it's so very succinctly put, bringing the stories of the Gopikas, bringing the stories of, you know, Pandavas and Gandhari, and the way it is portrayed. I mean, he's the whole thing, we've been going through this for the past 2-3 weeks. But so beautifully put in that one clip, and literally saying what you can start doing as you walk out of the discourse.
Yeah, sometimes it reminds me of, you know, like how a lawyer argues his case in the court. Mm. So at the beginning, you have to listen to the lot of the introduction, and it takes a long time, as literally, you know, he brings witness after witness after witness. But you know, even in books or in movies, the finally it is what is called as the peroration, that final
closing remarks,
the closing remarks of the lawyer, and that is what everyone looks forward to, because it carries the entire the summary or the in succinctly put, like what has been said, and that is what finally, you know, penetrates the minds of the jurors.
Right.
So it's and the literally the pace picks up, you know. It's like towards the end, and Swami is like line after line after line, like he's just you know, hitting our minds. It's like shattering every, you know, that concept that we hold on to. It's very 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 profound. I wish that, you know, we had more understanding of what Swami is speaking about. I'm pretty sure that as we read this, as we listen to this, whatever we speak about next is like one small facet of what has been delineated here. I'm pretty sure that this entire series of programs can be, you know, repeated year after year, and entirely new, you know, concepts can be.
How delineated. Swami started, I mean, it really beats you, the way Swami started with the concept of the indestructible and the destructible being one unit forming that akshara.
And
then from there he comes to the fact that the God and creation cannot be separated.
Correct.
And the creation might give many names to God, but God is only one.
Right.
Swami comes to that, and Swami says that this knowledge that everything is one is actually subjnana.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the knowledge that of the world, which is actually based on multiplicity, is jnana.
Correct.
And that wisdom within you, or intellect within you, which allows you to choose between the right and the wrong, and the good and the bad, and the pleasant and the unpleasant, that becomes vijnana. But the sugnana is one which understands this oneness. You know, Swami puts that as the base.
Yeah.
And then he explains how anybody who acts like on the basis of this sugnana or wisdom is dear to God. And then he gives the example of how the Pandavas were dear to Krishna.
Yeah. And in a sense, the essence of all sadhana, I think that is what, you know, this, as over here Swami says, or even the discourse is titled, this section is titled Transform Your Heart. And it gives us a very, like, insightful view into whatever sadhana we perform, like what are we looking for in that, like, as human beings, we are like geared towards getting results of out of anything we do. And in one sense, like Swami is telling us, like whatever sadhana you adopt, what is that base, you know, it should, what is it based on,
right?
So it's a really nice piece, you know, like. And here Swami is again bringing us back to the basic message of the Upanishads, that never forget that what the senses perceive is just like one part of the story.
Right.
Or maybe even, you know, a fraction of the story, as the, you know, Purusha Suktam tells us. Right. And so there is, on the one hand, what the senses perceive, and Swami calls it the kshara. And then there is side by side something that goes totally unrecognized by the senses, and which only maybe the heart can perceive. which is the akshara, the permanent, or and Swami puts it in a different way, there is the basis, the moolam, which goes unnoticed, which cannot be perceived, in fact. So, and then there is a gross, the sthulam, which is what the manifest, which we all experience. But if, you know, based on the story that we just read, so I was thinking, like, we have the an example in Gandhari's eldest son Duryodhana himself. There's a story in the before the Mahabharata war begins, and it is said that both Duryodhana and
Arjuna,
they come to the abode of Lord Krishna because they both seek his boon and they seek his help in fighting the war. They know that without his help it's going to be difficult, and so they enter, and Duryodhana, he walks in and he sees that Krishna is lying down, and he decides that you know, he'll rest or he will wait for Lord Krishna. So what he does is he sits beside his head. So the as the story goes, that he sits beside his head, and that itself tells us the like how arrogant a person that is. Whereas as Arjuna walks in, he is very happy because now he can sit at Lord Krishna's feet. And the next thing is when Lord Krishna wakes up, he first sees, naturally the first person is eyes fall are then Arjuna. And then he notices Duryodhana sitting beside him. And then he asks them both, like, what have you come for? And Lord Krishna is so fair that he gives the opportunity to the person who walked into the room first, which is Duryodhana. So he says, you know, cousin Duryodhana, what is it that you seek? You know, so this is where the Duryodhana makes, you know, that colossal mistake, which is to choose the gross, which in this case turns out to be, he makes a choice that he wants Lord Krishna's army.
Right.
And that leaves Arjuna, who is very, very secretly very, very happy. But he knows that...
I think it's actually the other way around. Arjuna is given the choice first.
Is it? Oh, okay.
And because
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
The way Krishna argues is, he says, first I saw Arjuna.
Arjuna,
so you
okay.
might have come first.
Right, right.
And then he says that even otherwise, Arjuna is the younger, so the younger one should be given the preference.
Okay, I somehow missed that. That's all right. Yeah,
that's
thank
okay.
you. Yeah, so...
So when Arjuna makes the choice, actually Duryodhana is
secretly
extremely
happy. Okay, I seem to have heard version 2.0. So
yeah, I think might as well, Swami might as well narrate it both ways actually.
Yeah.
Right.
So the thing is that the choices that they both make, like, so you can see that Arjuna, he goes with the base, with the moolam, because he recognizes that once he has the Lord, he has everything. And whereas it is Duryodhana who makes the choice of, you know, picking up the manifest, that is the army of the Lord, not the Lord himself. I recall another incident. This was a very close friend of mine, he had narrated, and Swami had taken him to Kodaikanal when he was still in school, like in his 12th class. And he was a very bright student and he had his heart set on medicine. So he wanted to be a doctor. And he had made up his mind that he would, you know, take Swami's blessing and go for medical studies. And that's what he wanted to do. And so somewhere he got the opportunity, you know, he thought he would tell Swami, but the words didn't come out of his mouth. So it somewhere in his mind it was, you know, somehow to tell Swami. And that, you know, the Lord is, he knows our mind. So, Swami that day called the student in Kodaikanal. He said, now come with me, I'll be distributing, you know, some clothes or whatever to the Sevadal who done duty over here. And as they're entering a particular row, Swami says, listen carefully to, or watch carefully what happens next. So, as they come down the line and they... Swami stops in front of a particular devotee. And the devotee, he says, Swami, I don't want anything else, but I want to be with you. Give me that opportunity one way or the other. I want to serve you. Okay, Swami says, you know, he blesses him and then walks on. And then he asks the student, do you know what that person's profession is? So the student says, no. He says, that person is a doctor.
Okay.
And he is praying to me for the chance to serve me, and that's all Swami said and went on. So it is like so very for him. It was a, you know, something that really shook him.
You know, that very similar to what Saiprakash shares about his Kodai visit, right? I think after his BSc, Swami was insisting that he should go and do medicine. Because Swami always, till the end, had this very strong opinion that medicine should be done after BSc. Right. You know, because generally people go after 12th standard. And I've heard Swami himself say this. You know, in my opinion, it is good if you go after BSc. That's when you get a little bit of maturity to learn medicine. That's why many of the students that Swami would send for medicine, that would be after BSc.
Right.
There are boys who have gone for medicine even after BSc physics.
That's pretty strange. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, Samprakash Swami was going on telling him that you should go for medicine. And Anil Kumar sir was part of that trip that time. And we know Anil Kumar sir, before he joined the university, he used to do a lot of coaching for medical entrance exam. So Swami would tell Anil Kumar sir, you coach this boy, let him go for the entrance. And Saiprakash was saying that he was not very keen because he wanted to continue with his MSc because he'd been with Swami all the while and he wanted to continue. But he did not have really the heart to tell Swami. You know, we all know that we have to listen to Swami. Then Swami was going on with this for weeks together, and suddenly one day in Kodai, Swami asks him that, do you want to do medicine? Do you really want to do medicine? So Saiprakash actually came up with a very beautiful answer. He said, Swami, if to be with Swami, I need to study anything more, I am prepared for it. Right? And Swami, immediately the answer which Swami gave us, to be with Swami is anything necessary. Is education necessary to be with Swami? Swami said, Akkar ledu, you do stay here and do your MSc. And that's how we have Saiprakash with us in part of Radio Sai. But that's what it is, you know. I mean, the beauty was the answer which he gave.
Yeah.
Because he said, Swami, I don't know what you want me to do, what I'm going to do.
Fantastic. Yes.
I want this. I want to be with you.
Right.
So you decide, you know, if doing being a doctor is necessary for that, then you fit it into my life. Otherwise, you know, that's precisely because when Arjuna goes and says, Krishna, I want you. He says, I'd rather have you on my side and lose the war than not having you and win the war.
Fantastic.
You know? And that's precisely what Swami is referring to. That the Swami starts that clip with that statement, right? You know, the one who wins God's kind glances, he wins everything. There is no doubt about that. You know, you might have pitfalls on your way, you might have ups and downs, but eventually he's the one who wins. Because that's the whole idea, you know. That's the purpose of the soul is to one day win that grace and be, you know, win that ultimate reward.
Right.
And then Swami goes on to this very beautiful and, you know, interaction between Gopikas and Krishna. I mean, I think this is the place where so effortlessly Swami bridges devotion with the ultimate wisdom of the Upanishads. No, because, I mean, purely from the point of view of a devotee who is madly in love with God. You know, Gopikas come and tell him, you know, Krishna, we see you now, but we see you even when you're not in front of us. You know, that is the idea. The devotee is all the time thinking of the Lord, and they say that the form which we see in front of you is physical and it goes away and comes. But there is another form within us which we are seeing all the time. So that seems to be more eternal, you know, the form which we see in our mind that we think of all through the day.
Right.
And so they're saying the form which the eye sees is not permanent. You know, it's such a simple logic they've come up with purely out of observing their love for Krishna and how it is panning out in their life.
Correct. Because in fact, Swami, just before that, he you know, kind of, he speaks about how, you know, scholars, they give the various interpretations of Lord Rama, what he is, Lord Krishna,
right,
what he is, and how we should not be taken in by that. We should always recognize that who we are speaking about at such times is divinity itself. And that to be, so the entire, whatever we read about Lord Rama, Lord Krishna and their lives is to be seen in that context.
Right.
Not in the physical context. It may give an entirely different interpretation which many scholars are likely to pounce upon. And so Swami say, in that context he says that, you know, when the Gopikas were so simple minded. You know, they are unlearned, and in contrast to the scholars, that they say that when they, what we perceive with our eyes of you, again, that our eyes may be deceiving us as to who you truly are.
And again, they say that there is this form which we see reflected of our mind. But maybe even that, you know, sometimes you're angry with Swami, sometimes you're upset with Swami.
Projecting.
Sometimes there is, you know, that emotion overflowing with devotion.
Yeah.
So he's saying that even that doesn't seem to be stable.
Correct.
So it's almost like the reflection of a moss-filled lake.
Yes, and the next paragraph that, you know, the conversation that these Gopikas have, I think that is so very, very beautiful because it conveys a lot of things. and just to go through it, you know, it's worth talking it up, talking about it in detail. The way they say is this, like, our pupil is dark and your form is also dark. So they now they're kind of comparing like their heart to that pupil which is dark, right? And they're saying that when that reflection is seen, I mean, when that reflection of your dark form in our dark pupil happens, like, there is no Krishna seen within us, in our eyes. And so then, what are they asking the Lord to do? So, they're asking the Lord not to change anything else about them, not to change their, you know, their dark eyes, not the, this thing, the form of the Lord, but to change the sky. So that now, you know, that in that reflection of the white sky, the Lord can be seen. And it's very important that the devotee himself is not seen. It's just the against that white sky, the Lord's form is seen. And Swami says the inner significance of this is the devotees are not asking the Lord, of course, not to change their bodies, not asking anything at the physical level, not even at the mental level. They're saying not even our mind. And there is something very, very beautiful about this, that there is enormous amount of wisdom in
wisdom,
this,
right?
Yeah, in this prayer to the Lord, that do not even change our mind. Then what is it that they're asking the Lord to transform? Is just their heart, which is to grant them, you know, wisdom, the highest possible wisdom, which is the essence of the Upanishads, in fact. Because as very often Swami would talk about the mind and its nature. So in the Upanishads, in many places, the mind is actually, it is given the name Ashwa, the horse.
Yes, horse.
Because a horse is something that cannot even be still when it is sleeping. It's standing, and even when it is appears to be sleeping, either it's, you know, suddenly the ears flap or the tail starts wiggling a little bit, you know, but it's never still. So that is the allegory, you know, that is the comparison that the Upanishads make of the mind. So the mind is something that is never still, and it is a hopeless, you know, quest to silence the mind. It's like Swami says that even if you take one small attribute of yours, something that over years has developed us, a certain trait of your mind, and let's say, you know, we have a predilection for anger, jealousy, I don't know which. And Swami says, like, if you're trying to work on that, it is like trying to straighten out the tail of a dog. And that straightening out, it may happen, it's temporary, but as soon as your hands are off, it curls back again. Right? So, in that sense, they have gone straight, you know, they've gone straight to the Lord and said that what you need to transform is our hearts. Which in our context would also mean that the conversation that we have about who we are.
Right.
That because we keep telling ourselves so many different things about who we are. We say not just that we are the body, that I am a teacher, or I am a medical professional, I am a finance analyst. You know, there are so many things, that I am a father, I am a mother, I am a husband, daughter-in-law, son-in-law. The list is endless of what we identify ourselves with. Right. And going back to that basic conversation of who we are.
Actually, you know, even as Swami was describing about that prayer which the Gopikas make, I don't know who it is. There's one of these poets, maybe Jayadeva, I'm not too sure. He writes about this episode where, you know, the Gopikas come and confront Krishna, and they ask him, what is the difference between us and Radha? You know, why are you so fond of her? And, you know, she seems to be getting
the
better share of the cake all the time. So that time, actually, it seems Krishna tells them this. Okay, now you look into my eyes. Okay, they are standing in front of him. They say, look into my eyes. What do you see? Okay, they say, we see our reflection. You know, when you look at someone's pupil, you see the reflection. So then Krishna says that when I look into your eyes, I see my reflection. But you know what happens when I look into Radha's eyes? Krishna says, I see Radha. I don't see my form. And you go and ask Radha what she sees when she looks into my eyes. And Radha reveals that when I look into Krishna's eyes, I actually see the form of Krishna and not my form. So that's when Krishna says that she has literally become me. You know, she is no more a devotee who loves me, but she has become one with the Lord in that devotion.
Right.
And as you're saying, that it's coming back to that same question of, have you completely given up who you are?
Yeah.
And become one with the Lord? I think that's what the literally coming down to that idea. And the beautiful thing of, you know, the point which Swami is making, which the Upanishads many times mention, is we give way too importance to the mind. You know, we think that all the problem starts and ends in the mind, and we all our solutions are, you know, confined to the realm of the mind.
Correct.
And here Swami is saying it's the mind has got nothing to do. It's almost like, as you were saying, it's the horse. It's all about, you know, who's sitting with the whip and who's guiding it. It's all behind the mind. Correct. The mind will just be a tool as long as the mind is, you know, guided in the right way.
In a sense, like, let the mind be and do what it does.
Right, what it's meant to do.
Trying to change the nature of the mind, or play with it, trifle with its nature. It's like putting your hand right in the, there's a machinery, you know, it's going on, and you're trying to put your hand right in the thick of that. Only your hand will get chopped off, and nothing changes about the machinery. One more really nice thing is, again, we see the same theme, like Swami comes back to devotion. Time and again. We begin with something, the Upanishads are almost like an intellectualization of, you know, what spirituality is. But Swami, time and time again, he reminds us, perhaps we could very easily get lost in that whole intellectual discussion. But to bring it back to the aspect of love. And here it is very clear why, you know, why Swami brings it back. One thing, when you look at the Gopikas, now, that love has not blinded them. That love has taken the blinkers off their eyes. This is, as Swami says, no, that one should rise in love and not fall in love. The kind of clarity that has got conferred on the Gopikas because of their devotion to the Lord. And that is why Swami, you know, brings us back to the aspect of
And of course, this analogy which Swami ends with is brilliant, where Swami is talking about the charcoal.
Yeah.
I think in other discourses, Swami gives the example. There's no way you can whiten the charcoal by washing it in milk, that Padya which Swami sang, or by washing it with soap, because it ends up turning everything else black. The only way you can turn it into white is when you completely burn it to the stage of
the
vibhuti. Now, when you look at it, there's another analogy which Swami gives, using the same charcoal, where Swami says the charcoal is black, but when you throw it into the fire, it becomes, luminescent.
Right. Correct.
It becomes
glowing.
It starts glowing with the flame. It almost says, I mean, it's typically the situation of all of us who call ourselves devotees. Now, here is the flame which, you know, is God. And we actually go in and come out when we have a need.
Right.
And for a minute or for some time when we are in association with that, or when the coal becomes an ember, it is red. But eventually it starts becoming blacker and blacker when it keeps going in and coming out. As per convenience. Swami is saying, once you go in, you remain there. You know, don't use God, but use the world to reach God. The moment you're there, don't come out. Let the fire burn you completely till the point of whiteness.
Fantastic. Yes.
Right? I mean, it's amazing analogy which Swami is given, because he's saying that don't stop. You know, you have found God.
Yeah.
That's the beautiful flow, you know. Swami started by win the grace of God. You know, same as the case with Kauravas. They found God, but they let him pass, right? He came up to Krishna and he took a favor from Krishna. It's almost like the coal stepping into the fire and coming out, but did not travel that full distance.
Yeah, because as he says over here, the coal is formed only when the burning is incomplete.
Incomplete, right.
You remain coal as long as you don't let the entire process happen. So, as Swami puts it, I've forgotten the journey, you know, I've forgotten the beginning and the end of the journey. I'm midway through this journey, and that's when, like, my mind is like this, black charcoal. It's a fantastic analogy, really, where that you want it to turn white. You know that that's the end of the journey, right? And you've been given the means also. But as you said, because that out of our attachment to the world or, you know, various things that we are committed to, we try to come out of that from time to time. And in the end, it is like the wisdom that allows us to remain with Lord, you know, with have Him complete the process that He has started. And that completes, you know, our reaching that final destination of being white like Vibhuti.
And Swami even uses this chant which we do at the end of all prayers, Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Swami says, don't come to God only for physical shanti or mental shanti. It has to be for all three, you know, entities which make this human body.
Right.
You know, the physical, the mental, and the spirit which you truly are. Swami says that is the whole idea of shanti shanti. I mean, how true it is. you know, we want the first two shantis. That is enough for us, you know, physical comfort and a little bit of mental peace.
Yeah.
But we don't want to take that last mile.
Mm-hmm. It's like literally, it's at the identity is praying for what it wishes.
It wishes, exactly.
What it wishes, but Swami says there's a standpoint beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think really when we say shanti, 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 that final shanti, that is the frontier at which we are standing.
Right? Swami ends by saying that, you know, Namasmarana has the ability to grant that. Namasmarana is very important in this regard. For mental peace, a divine outlook is essential. Finally, for the peace of the heart and consciousness, spiritual practice is the path.
Hmm.
So Swami says that is Namasmarana. It will give you physical, mental, and will reach you, you know, till that point of whiteness which Swami was talking about.
Right. So in a sense, like, you know, we've the Mundaka Upanishad begins with that question from the you know, householder,
right. Right,
and to the sage, and you know, the whole discourse is about essentially gearing yourself for that final journey,
right. Right.
This is again Shaunaka, we should remember, is a person who's fairly come along, you know. Mm. He's been doing so many of the spiritual activities, like such as yagas and sacrifices. And he is asking the questions of sage.
I mean, that's what they say in commentaries of the Upanishad. When he comes and says, what is that knowledge by gaining which I can gain everything?
Everything, yes.
He's aware of the fact that there is some knowledge
there
like that.
There is some knowledge there.
There is a base which is, you know, which stands for all knowledge.
Correct.
And that knowledge itself shows that it is, you know, there is a certain amount of progress in his understanding.
Exactly.
And that's why he's asking that question. And again, very similar to what Swami told in the previous discourse, where he was speaking about, you know, whether it was Omkar, he was saying the physical benefits and the ultimate benefits,
yeah.
Or for that matter, Dakshinayanam and Uttarayanam, and Swami was talking about that there is always benefit to get within the world, within, as you were saying, in the identity which we are holding. But the real benefit is in giving up that identity which we are holding on to.
And the, they coexist. They are literally side by side. As Swami is saying, the Moolam and the Sthulam, they are side by side.
Right.
And
the
Kshara and the Akshara, they coexist. And it is for us to you know, kind of intuit or at least stand in that it is available to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what ultimately... like, so as the, you know, Gopikas, they pray to Krishna, we can only pray to the Lord that let us also, you know, complete this entire process and move from charcoal to vibhuti.
I mean, we'll have to end with that. What a beautiful thought, what a beautiful analogy which Swami has given.
Yes.
I mean, it really completes the discourse. I mean, it's not just that the discourse ends,
yes.
It's really
the end of the spiritual journey.
As a theme, as a you know, complete feeling, it really feels that that's a complete discourse in that sense.
Right.
So, nothing more but to offer our gratitude to Swami for giving us such gems and giving us the opportunity to re-listen and re-ruminate over these concepts. On behalf of all of you listeners and on behalf of Ari and myself, I offer gratitude at Swami's lotus feet. Dear listeners, the next week we'll begin with the next discourse in the series. So you'll have to join us again next week at 7:30 for that. But for now, in a short while, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment and the last segment of the day, which is the Vahini Satsang. As Bishu told you, that we also have a special guest joining them today. So stay tuned and happy listening.